I'm going to start with a question. When was the last time you used the word providence? And I don't mean in reference to the capital of Rhode Island. When did you last use it? Okay, now, quick straw poll. If you've used it in the last week, would you put up your hands? You creep. Right? If you've used it in the last... Oh, you've done. Oh, yes, he emailed me about it. That's all right. How many of you have used it in the last month? Very good. The last year? All right, hands down. How many of you, to the best of your recollection, have never used it? Less than I thought. It's clearly not a word we use very often. In fact, it has rather an old-fashioned tone to it. And yet, I can't think of any modern equivalent, and I've looked at various dictionaries to see. I don't think there is a modern equivalent. It's almost as though the concept is quietly being forgotten. In fact, there may be some of you here who don't actually know what it means, and just in case you're too shy to ask, it broadly refers to God's guardianship, his care and control of our lives. And that's the subject of our sermon today. In past weeks, we've looked at God's awesome creation of the world, his rule of the world, his judgment of the world. And now we come to look at his oversight of our lives for good. And we're going to do that by looking at perhaps the most memorable story in the whole Bible, the account of the life of Joseph. In order to understand what happened to Joseph, you have to understand his family background. A number of you will remember that Jacob wanted to marry Rachel, but he was tricked by his uncle into marrying her sister Leah instead, and then had to work another 7 years for the hand of Rachel. Incidentally, Genesis chapter 2 makes it very clear that God's purposes were for one man to join one woman in marriage. But at the time of the patriarchs, polygamy was accepted, and Genesis does not overtly condemn it. It just points out the disaster that results from it, and Jacob's family was one such example. Rather unsurprisingly, Jacob loved Rachel but did not love Leah. And in compensation for that, we are told that God enabled Leah to have children, but did not enable Rachel to have children. And Leah had, in reasonably quick succession, 4 boys. And with every birth, Rachel became more upset. Until finally, she said to Jacob, "Look, why don't you take my servant Bilhah as a concubine and have children through Bilhah?" By the way, Jacob somewhat unrealistically said to Rachel, "Aren't I good enough for you? Do you really need children?" And she said, "No, you're not good enough. I want children." So Bilhah had children, and she had 2 sons. Now, in case you think this was all friendly, Rachel then said, "I have fought a battle with my sister and I've won." This was family rivalry of intense proportions. And Leah then persuaded Jacob to take her servant, Zilpah, and have children by Zilpah. And 2 more sons resulted. And then 2 more for Leah and a daughter. And then finally, Rachel conceived and gave birth to Jacob's 11th son, Joseph. Now, it was perhaps inevitable that Jacob would not love Leah as he loved Rachel. What was totally unforgivable is that he transferred that favoritism onto her son, Joseph. And the situation was made worse when, tragically, a few years later, Rachel died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin, Jacob's 12th and last son. And Jacob expressed that favoritism in many ways. The most famous, of course, was in giving Joseph a magnificent coat. It's very easy to misunderstand the significance of that. It's very easy to imagine the coat as some sort of rather sort of hippie-type garment, Joseph and the Technicolor dream coat. Or perhaps to imagine it as a sort of rather fancy little number, a sort of rather effeminate gown which he gave a twirl to his brothers with. If it had been like that, they'd have exhibited contempt. But it wasn't like that. The whole point about this cloak is it was a gown of the type that a king would wear. It expressed Jacob's favoritism and expressed the conference of authority on Joseph. And the result was his brothers hated him as a result. And they hated him all the more because he brought bad reports of his brothers by his father's concubines, saying that they were not exercising good stewardship over his father's flocks. And then, of course, there were the dreams. The dreams that suggested that Joseph at least believed that he was going to rise above his brothers and rule over them. Now, whether Joseph was wise to tell his brothers about those dreams is quite a difficult question. At very least, it was a little bit naive to tell them about them. However, he was only 17. His father was hardly setting him a good example. And in any event, the key point that the Bible wants us to learn is not the point about whether Joseph was wise or otherwise. The key point is that these dreams were from God. God knew that hard times lay ahead for Joseph, and he revealed to Joseph that all would be all right, that Joseph would be exalted in the end. Incidentally, in recent years, there have been some within the church, I mean the church at large rather than this church, who would want us to believe that God does not know the future. Now, I understand their motives. Well, just about. But I can hardly stress too strongly, they are wrong. A large part of our trust in God depends on his omniscience. The fact that he sees the future, he knows what is going to happen. The Bible stresses that time and again. I could give any number of examples of it, but I'll just give two. First of all, there's Isaiah chapter 46. It says this: I am God, and there is none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. And on a more personal level, take this from Psalm 139. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. God revealed to Joseph what was going to happen to him. He did so because God is outside time. We're back to Genesis chapter 1. He created it. God reveals the end from the beginning, and he did so to Joseph. Well, the dreams may have been from God, but that didn't improve the brothers' humour. And they decided to do away with Joseph. I haven't got time to run through the whole of the rest of the story, at least not in detail. Can I recommend you all read it? It's Genesis 37 to 50. For those of you who are doing the reading program, it's divided up into chunks for the next 7 days. And for those of you who aren't, I suggest you do it nonetheless over the coming week. But very broadly, what happened is this. The brothers decided to kill Joseph, but were talked out of it by the oldest brother, Reuben. At least he did something right. Unfortunately, while he was away, presumably tending some part of the flocks, some Ishmaelite, Midianite traders came past, and the brothers suddenly discovered they could make 20 shekels, and they did. The Midianite traders went down to Egypt. By the way, it was a well-established trade route through Dothan. They went down to Egypt, and they sold Joseph to the captain of Pharaoh's guard, Potiphar. Now, Joseph was educated, and he was reliable. And he rose up to become in charge of the whole of Potiphar's household. In that capacity, he came to the notice of Potiphar's wife, who attempted to seduce him. He refused. In a jealous rage, she claimed he'd tried to rape her. Joseph was arrested. He was somewhat lucky not to be executed. And he was put in the prison, which was doubtless run by Potiphar. He then rose again. He was reliable. He effectively became in charge of his fellow prisoners. And then one day he interpreted the dreams of two fellow prisoners correctly. He hoped that that would lead to his release. But sadly, the cupbearer to Pharaoh, who was one of those two prisoners, forgot to tell Pharaoh what had happened. And as a result, Joseph languished in jail for a further 2 years. It was at that point that his fortunes changed, because Pharaoh himself had two dreams which disturbed him. In the first, he saw 7 magnificent sheaves of corn and 7 rather flimsy ones. And the flimsy ones consumed the good ones and still remained flimsy. And then he saw 7 cows come out of the Nile, fat ones, followed by 7 thin ones. And the thin ones ate the fat ones and stayed thin. At that point, the cupbearer said, yes, I was supposed to tell you something. There's this guy in jail. And he brought Joseph before Pharaoh. Joseph interpreted the dreams, saying that 7 years of abundance were to follow, and then 7 years of famine. And in perhaps the first recorded incidents of Keynesian economics, suggested that they should save some of the abundance and save it for the 7 years of famine. Pharaoh was not unnaturally impressed by this and took Joseph as his, his vizier in charge of the entire domestic policy of Egypt. It was an extraordinary turnaround for Joseph. He had gone from jail with the threat of death hanging over him to number 2 in Egypt in a trice. But more was to come, because 9 years later, 2 years into the famine, things were getting pretty tough. And his brothers came to Egypt in order to beg for food. And they appeared before Joseph and bowed down before him in supplication, in fulfillment of the dreams. Joseph put them through a series of tests and then made himself known to them. And finally, he invited them all, together with their whole entourage, his father and all, to come down to Egypt, where they settled in the Nile Delta and lived there with their descendants for the next 400 years. Joseph himself stayed in the service of Pharaoh throughout his life before dying very wealthy at a great old age. That's the history. The question is, what does it teach us? And I can offer you alternatives. On the one hand, we have the Sir Timothy Rice view of Genesis, the writer of the lyrics of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Don't worry, I'm not going to sing it to you. I did once on stage, but I'm not going to this time. His explanation is quite simple. It goes like this. Greatest man since Noah only goes to Shoah. I leave aside the poetry. Greatest man since Noah only goes to Shoah. Anyone from anywhere can make it if they get a lucky break. Doesn't cut it, does it? That is not the explanation of Genesis. Let me read you what Joseph himself said. This is Joseph talking to his brothers as he made himself known to them. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed, and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 there will not be ploughing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt.'" You see, Joseph knew about providence. Joseph knew the truth of what Paul was to write 1800 years later. For in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. Note what Joseph didn't say. He didn't say, if you love God, everything will be all right. His life had taught him that that simply wasn't the case. Equally importantly, he did not say, God does a lot of good things in our lives. Sadly, there are also a lot of bad things, but the good news is the good things generally outweigh the bad things or overcome the bad things. He did not say that. His faith was far, far deeper than that. He understood that God had a purpose for his life. He understood that God had a purpose of doing good for him and through him to do good for others. In other words, he understood God's providence. He knew that in all the things that had happened to him, God was working out those purposes. So, does that justify Jacob's favoritism? Of course it doesn't. Does that mean that the brothers were doing good when they sold him into slavery in Egypt? Of course not. What they did was evil. What about the revenge of Potiphar's wife? What about the forgetfulness of the cupbearer? What about Joseph's own naivety? Are all those justified by that? No, of course they're not. That's not the lesson that this teaches. The point is that none of Jacob, his brothers, Potiphar's wife, the cupbearer, or Joseph himself, none of them were in control of the situation. God was in control. Providence. Of course, we can see that. Joseph also could see it, at least in later life. He wrote this. This is him talking to his brothers. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. You were trying to do one thing, you were evil. God, he was overruling for good. But that's what Joseph said in later life. I wonder whether it was quite so easy to understand that earlier on. Joseph was 17 when he was sold into slavery. It was 13 years later that he finally rose and became Pharaoh's number two. It was another 9 years before he was reunited with his family. We know, because the Bible tells us on a number of occasions, that God was in control the whole time. But Joseph only had two things. He had the dreams that God had graciously given him, and he had his general faith in God and in God's providence. And he clung on to those things. So was Joseph unique? Well, in one sense, he clearly was, because God was working through Joseph to fulfill his promises to Abraham. Another example of God foretelling the future. But as regards this matter of providence, Joseph is nothing other than a simple example, one of many examples of God's providence. I could have given many others. Consider Esther, for example. Esther, 1400 years later, became wife of the Persian king and was used in that capacity to save her people. What about St. Paul? He recognized when he was in jail that God was working out his purposes there because the whole guard of the jail came to hear the gospel. These are just examples. They're examples of the fact that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. That's true of our lives as much as it was true of Joseph. There is no modern word meaning providence, but there doesn't have to be. The old one will do very nicely. And if you can't remember what it means, can I suggest you just remember the story of Joseph?